have you join me for the Yes to Life show. If this is your first time here, then you may not know that the show is named after the charity I set up over a decade ago to help people with cancer to access integrative medicine. And you may not also know that integrative medicine is the term now being used for a broad synthesis of approaches to cancer that includes both conventional methods and the full range of complementary and alternative techniques. This week's show is a little unusual. I'm travelling down to Waterloo to meet Dr. Seth Rankin. Dr. Rankin is a GP. He's a clinical commissioner, which means he's on a board that decides where NHS spending goes. And he's also involved in a group of private GP practices offering convenient services for minor ailments, etc., in London. So he's got a few different hats, and he's got a view of our health services that should prove interesting. I'm really pleased to have you on the show. Clinical commissioners, the kind of people we hear about, we don't often speak to them. So very, very interesting. So it's a difficult time for the NHS, there's no doubt about that. I don't think there's anybody who'd pretend otherwise. But whatever its shortcomings, and there are a few, the NHS is almost universally loved and approved of by the British public for its principle, really, I think, of caring for everybody equally. But it's equally at a very challenging place right now, where its ability to even continue to do that is under threat, I'd say. So maybe you can give us, if this is possible, a brief analysis of why you think it's at this position right now, what it is that's led us to this place.
Yeah, I think, look, the NHS does do an amazing job, as you said. Yeah. People do love it. It's loved with almost religious intensity in many circles.
I agree.
And people should be rightly proud of it. It's done an amazing job, and it still does an amazing job of looking after the health of the nation. But, you know, in short, the problem with the NHS at the moment is it's run out of cash.
Right. That's the simple answer.
Now, look, there's all sorts of efficiencies that could be made from the way that the NHS is run, but it's been around now for 70 years and it's developed a culture. It's got employment contracts. It has systems and things in place that are, frankly, incredibly difficult to change. So coming along and expecting to do some sudden big change that's going to make a huge amount of difference and quickly free up millions of pounds, I would personally think is impossible. It's just not going to happen. So it really, right now, needs a little bit more cash. And I think that's actually a reasonable proposition. The entire health economy in the UK, private and public, actually only constitutes a spend of less than 9% of the GDP, which is a phenomenally low amount of money across the world in every equivalent OECD country. Mm-hmm. So I say that's not just the public spend, that's the private included. Right. It's less than 9%, which is an extraordinary low amount. And you increase that by 0.5%, you're probably going to fix an awful lot of the problems that are currently
short-term
in the NHS. Short-term fix. Long-term, I would honestly say I don't think you really need to fix much. I mean, it's okay. It does all of the things that, almost all of the things that you would expect from a health service. It does keep people alive. It provides the most high-level, high-tech interventions of pretty much anywhere else on the world provides. If you need a kidney transplant, if you need any type of operation, it's available on the NHS. And actually the waiting, believe it or not, the waiting times in the NHS are nowhere near as bad as compared with other countries in the world as what people think. The thing that it just doesn't do is convenience. And that's a real difficulty. It is a real difficulty for all of us, there's no doubt. But the NHS rightly devotes pretty much all of its resources to the most vulnerable in society. That's what a public service should do. So mm-hmm. that's what it does. And the most vulnerable take the majority of the time. And trying to do that at the same time as fit in an 11 o'clock appointment for a busy working person is honestly, it's frankly impossible. Mm. And I think that the NHS was conceived in a time of great need and also poverty, maybe too strong a word, because, you know, but it was, the country was broke.
It was a very different country then.
It was broke, you know. And it it was conceived in that time. But since then, the country has become much wealthier. And the amount of money that's spent on the NHS in terms of proportion of that wealth is not really kept up. And what but what's really interesting to, be, to me is that the private sector, which should be there to fill that gap between the absolute core need that we all have and the convenience that we'd all expect with the kind of lifestyles and the international type sort of understanding that we have of health services, it's failed to keep up with fulfilling that gap. And I think that's probably my general sense is that we should give the NHS just a little bit more money, leave it alone to do what it does, really, just leave it alone to do what it does, and the, allow and celebrate the parallel private system, which could provide the convenience for the people that can afford it and the people that are working, etc., etc. And that tends to be how systems work in other parts of the world. That that sort of a level of convenience fits in more with a fee-for-service system, where the harder the doctor works, the more money they make. And that's not the way it works in the NHS. If you, as a GP, you register with me as a GP, I would get, it depends, it's fair, but let's say £80-90 per year for you being on my books. If you come 100 times, I get paid exactly the same as if you come never, if you never come at all.
Right.
So, whereas pretty much most other services on the world, if you were to come 100 times, you get paid 100 times more than if you come none at all. So, utterly different in terms of convenience. That doesn't necessarily keep you any healthier. That's the really important thing to remember.
Yeah.
It just means that you probably feel a little bit better treated. You probably have a bit of a sort of a better experience of customer service. So I think the as in so many other aspects of English culture, having the that compromise between the public and private should be probably developed more than it is.
All right, well, there's quite a few things in what you've said so far we could go into.
good.
So look, first of all, I just want to look at, as you rightly pointed out, things are different from when the NHS was formed. There's a lot more money around. But of course, the NHS is using a lot more money.
Yeah.
And one of the kind of, I would say, obvious reasons for that is that what the NHS is doing has changed dramatically. The thing they've always done, and that, as you pointed out, they do incredibly well, is acute care.
Yeah.
I mean, they are. They're right up there, aren't they? If you want to, if you go have a heart attack, you know, you need a bypass, they're bloody good, aren't they? You know, they're really good.
Yeah.
But during this period, all the chronic conditions have all developed. And, you know, the yes, we're all living longer, but, you know, generally speaking, we're living longer with a few chronic conditions, which are all being treated and looked after. And it seems that this is really where a huge slab of the NHS resources is getting sucked up now, and it doesn't show any sign of abating yet. It actually looks like it's going to get worse. So therefore, you know, a short-term fix of a bit more money is not going to address that, I would feel. What do you think about that?
Well, when you say short-term, it depends how short-term. If you put a lot more money, which has actually just been talked about recently, a lot more money into primary care, where the management of chronic conditions is much better done, then that's going to make a quite a bit of difference. Hospitals and secondary care are very, very expensive. Absolutely essential. You know, there's nothing more essential than an expert to fix the plumbing in your heart when you're having a heart attack. But when you you've got a long-term condition, it's much, much better placed in primary care. And by far, the majority of people would much prefer to be treated at home, if they possibly could, if it's safe, than taken into hospital.
Yeah.
But it needs, at the moment, general practice takes about 8%. Primary care takes about 8% of the NHS budget. So of that cash that the whole system needs, a significant proportion of it needs to be shifted into primary care. And that, you know, and there's lots and lots of work being done on that. People are trying to set up systems in primary care so that not as many people end up going into hospital. Once again, it's difficult. There's certainly no overnight answers to that. You know, habits and the whole system is tends to be focused towards secondary care. In all of our minds, the thought of where we really, really need to go when something's really wrong is to the hospital. That's where they have all the machines, that's where they have all the experts, the specialists. And sometimes that's absolutely appropriate, but on many other occasions it's not. And that's a long, slow process to put the resources in and then educate patients gently, nudge them towards a more appropriate place for them to be treated.
So a lot of the discussion in recent years has been in the direction of actually getting in there before the problem, in fact. I mean, you know, so many of the chronic conditions, they are their lifestyle conditions, basically. And therefore, you know, actually prevention is much better than any of the answers you can give afterwards. So that involves moving money into an area which really doesn't have any money. It's not even been looked at as part of the health service to this point. So that's a further obstacle, but actually out of all the solutions to this spiralling chronic condition situation is the one that makes the most sense in terms of, you know, actually good results for the people who are getting sick, and also costs. I mean, because fixing the problem afterwards is much more expensive than stopping in the first place.
Absolutely. Look, there's absolutely no doubt that that's true. People would be much better served to live a healthy lifestyle. But, you know, people tend to do what people want to do. Now, we can do lots and lots of nudging, and the public health departments, which admittedly recently have had a lot of their funding limited, and some of the recent changes have thrown them into somewhat you know, difficult situations. But advertising campaigns and letting people know what it is they should do with prevention. But look, it is really an interesting problem, that, because doctors in their, you know, years of training, you know, 5-6 years of med school and then all the subsequent years after that, they're trained to treat conditions.
Yeah,
exactly.
I agree.
So it's kind of the wrong profession, and to be perfectly frank, it's the wrong profession to be talking to about prevention, because prevention, I hate to say, is really simple. It's above all, don't smoke, get a decent amount of exercise, eat a varied diet, and very important, don't eat too much of it. Whatever it is you eat, don't eat too much of it. So keep your weight down, keep fit, don't drink too much, drink in moderation. And that's it. That dramatically alters the odds of all of the conditions that we're talking about that you can make a difference to. There's nothing really more complicated than that. And there's an awful lot of more and more sort of advertising and awareness. People these days know, I mean, I've noticed, you know, the dramatic increase in people's knowledge about these things, and smoking rates are coming down, and interestingly, there does seem to be a leveling out of the obesity epidemic in the last things that people are looking at. So the tide may well be turning,
right?
But, you know, at the same time, eating can be an addiction, and trying to stop people from eating too much, trying to stop people from drinking too much, trying to stop people from smoking. These are all, you know, they're not easy things to do. So this, I suspect there's still going to be plenty of work for the doctors to clean up.
So you said you think that the doctor's actually the wrong place for this because they're not trained to it. But so there's two questions that come out of that is, should they be trained? So they know the difference between somebody who needs to change their lifestyle and somebody who actually really needs some medication? Or should somebody else take the role before they get to the doctor? Because there isn't a person. You can't go to, you know, who's the person before the GP? There isn't one.
Yeah. Well, there is. I mean, look, both is the short answer to that. And interestingly, GPs are getting more and more training in ways of helping people, to nudging people towards sensible life choices. But generally, they come to you when they've got a problem. You don't see them until they've got a problem.
Right.
They just don't. They don't bother coming to the GP. Now, there's a lot of things that go on that are trying to get people in. So, you know, the NHS put a lot of resources into over 40s health checks. So, they, you know, providing. And that turns up an awful lot of people, and you can change things. But there are, I should say, that there is quite a lot of different programs all over the country training health trainers, which are doing exactly what we're talking about. People are able to identify people, stop them in shopping centres and all sorts of things, and talk to them about healthy lifestyle choices. And I think both of those things should be developed. GPs need to have a bit more time, but they are really going to be always, just by the nature of it, picking up people that are perhaps in the early stages of diabetes, which they can then make a huge difference to. But as you say rightly, the intervention should start quite a bit earlier than that. And I think there is a much more cost-effective solution to that, because, you know, people who understand a little bit more about healthy lifestyle issues and can help people with that. But it's also, look, truthfully, it requires an awful lot of resources for just simply an advertising campaign. You know, if you have a lot more lovely looking fruit and vegetable stalls beside all of the train stations instead of, you know, the sort of the high carbohydrate, high fat type solutions that are tempting on your way home. Lots and lots more awareness of, even though there is lots already, but there could be more awareness of just what you should eat, what you should buy to eat, what you should do, how you should live your life. Things are slowly moving in that direction, but there's an awful lot more work that could be done.
So what would you see, can we just talk about the role of industry here?
Sure.
So you've got two big industries at work here. One of them is the food industry, which is wanting to sell lots of stuff. And then you have the pharmaceutical industry, which wants to sell lots of stuff too.
Yeah.
The pharmaceutical industry quite likes chronic disease, actually, because it's very profitable. And the food industry likes addictive food, actually, because that does very well. Now, both of these are kind of, they're theoretically held in check by regulatory bodies. But, you know, if you take the food industry, for example, the science to do with food seems to be a negotiation more than a fact. You know what I mean? It's like, well, these are the facts, and what's the food industry going to allow us to do? So we have to negotiate with them about it. So they get away with using their muscle, basically, to bend the science to suit themselves. And, and that happens in pharmaceuticals as well. It's all well documented now. Do you feel there's anything that can be done about this? Because, I mean, you know, you say the NHS or the government can't afford to advertise these things, but those businesses can, you can be sure. They can really afford to advertise them. And so they do, and so they make a huge headway with complete nonsense, basically selling you things that are bad for you as though they're good for you, you know, and this kind of thing. So how, I mean, there's only two answers to this. You either have to compete on the advertising front, or you have to curb what these businesses are allowed to do. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, honestly, it's a really, really interesting one, because there's so many different levels of that. There's absolutely no doubt that the food industry does try and make its product as attractive and, for want of a better word, addictive as possible. That's
health isn't the top of the list, is
absolutely,
it? Let's face
that makes sense. But by the same token, they provide a huge amount of employment, a huge amount of resources to society. And as a doctor, I've got to be honest, probably the most devastating health consequence that you see is people without jobs, you know, that can have incredible damage to their health. So, but these things, I'm not coming down one side or the other of these things, but they're always much, much more complex than you could first look at.
Of course.
I do think that of course, stuff needs to be honest. There's no question at all. If someone's advertising something as being fit and healthy, when it's not, that's wrong. And there should be regulation on that. There should be much clearer evidence as to what something's going likely to do to you, and people will of course still make their choices on that, and there could be an awful lot more work done. I don't know about banning things, but by the same token, look, cigarettes went down massively when they started banning the use of them in certain places.
Where,
you know, when they stopped people smoking in bars and restaurants, it dramatically reduced the number of people smoking. And I think that there's a massive potential for people who are wanting to lose weight, because you don't, you know, meet many people who really want to be overweight. In my life, the times I've lost weight have truly been the most blissful experience I can possibly imagine. Right. You wake up, look at yourself, you lost weight, and you feel great.
Good. Yeah.
It doesn't stop me from going back and eating too much and putting all the weight back on again, you know. But if the only food you can eat, and I know that, you know, absolutely no question on a personal level, if I want to lose weight, then the only food that should be in my fridge and cupboards are food that are healthy and are going to fill me up rather than make me hungry.
Hmm.
You know, so when I want to lose weight, I clean my cupboards
good
out,
food
I change
choices.
My and if across society, if there was different choices, different advertising, then I suspect that there would be quite a bit of change in human behaviour.
Hmm.
It's too big for me to really comment on as to whether we should go and ban these things or how much sort of it's
difficult. The pace of change is so unbelievably slow without some
absolutely
moves like that. I mean, that move that you highlighted there of the law on smoking.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's not just helped the people who don't smoke, it's helped us like Matt. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
yes, as you pointed out, it does actually help some people who actually don't want to smoke, even though they do. And so, you know, maybe occasionally some more drastic means are necessary. You know, the sugar thing has only just arrived, and it's 40 years old, the information of what sugar's been doing to people. You know, 40 years for a change like that? The amount of damage in the 40 years is just, like, incalculable in terms of health. And
True, there's no question. But look, it's really difficult, once again, things are always, you know, now sugar is energy, and the human body uses energy in whatever form you give it. To the human body, having really highly processed flour, to the human body, it's much the same as sugar. So at the moment, we're seeing a massive move against sugar, but it's kind of just part of the story.
It's part of the story. You're absolutely right. It is part of the story.
And look, you know, so
it's
much
the worst part. I
it
think
is.
So. Just straight sugar, just put in there in the form of fructose or syrup or whatever it is. That is the worst part. But you're right. It's there in all the refined foods.
Exactly. And you know, what's really, really interesting is that the evidence that I've seen is that, you know, because everything is broken down to the glucose molecule in order to be absorbed into the body.
Yeah.
Now, sucrose, sugar, needs to be broken down into a glucose molecule in order to be absorbed. A French baguette, the highly processed flour in that, the carbohydrate in that is broken down to a glucose molecule at pretty much exactly the same rate as sucrose. So as far as the body's concerned, spooning spoonfuls of sugar, of white sugar into your mouth, is much the same as having a baguette. But in our consciousness, it seems utterly different. We associate one with sort of, you know, rural France and lovely, wonderful, warm smelling things, and we are beginning to associate the other with something that is almost poison. So there's an awful lot of more stuff to this argument.
I agree, it's complex. I mean, when I look at things like that, I always try and look at, well, what's actually changed, right?
Yeah.
And baguettes have been around for a long time. So to me that says, well, all right, they can't be exactly equivalent. The thing that's changed is the amount of sugar that's just put in everything, you know, including bread products. You know, it's just been put into everything to make people want to buy it. So, you know, it's what industry has done to food that is the big change. You know, since, you know, industrial food was just really beginning to boom when I was young. You know, this is like, it was convenience. Of course, you want this. You can make a cake with some dried stuff and a bit of water and stir it up. And, it, you know, the fact it was mainly made by ICI was, you know, nobody even thought about that. And it was, you know, but so convenience was the thing. But, of course, that was decades ago, and it's gone way further than that now. And in many subtle ways. So to me, that is the primary change that's affected baguettes as much as Coca-Cola, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they've all changed. You know, the pint of milk we buy now is not the pint of milk that people bought 75 years ago. It just isn't. It's been through an industrial complex and come out the other end. And it maybe lasts a bit longer. It looks nice. The smell's good. All sorts of things have been done to it to make it sell better than the one down the road.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing that I'm so wary of. Well, what are they doing? And how good is that really for me, what they're doing? You know, so it's not that people were healthy 75 years ago. They were unhealthy then as well. But there are particular problems we have now, which they didn't really have then,
aren't there? There are, absolutely. Now, the thing is, remember, at the base of all of this, it's simply the amount that you eat. That's really what it is. The trouble with sugar and highly processed carbohydrates is that they make you hungry. They make you want to eat more. So in a very real way, they are addictive. You know, and I mean, just think about it yourself. Yeah, 200 calories worth of chicken breast is probably half a chicken breast, a decent sized chunk. You sit down and eat that by itself, you're going to feel full.
Yeah,
200 calories of white bread with jam on it is just one slice of toast. Right. One slice of toast with the butter and white jam. It's probably more than 200 calories. You and I know that I can hoover up half a loaf of that without even feel hungry at the end of it.
Yeah.
This is the difficulty with sugar. So it's and those type of easily digestible things. So it's actually, in a sense, it's the convenience that's the difficulty, you know.
Yeah.
So even in a what they call an obesogenic diet, which is what we're in, where there's so many foods that make you hungry and are promoting obesity, it still comes down to the amount. And in truth, in a moral sense, in a body sense, there's nothing wrong with a spoonful of sugar. It's just that if you have a spoonful of sugar, you're likely to want a cupful.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, all things in moderation, that's right. But I would agree with that.
But if you're going to lose weight, definitely cut that out, because that's going to drive your appetite.
Mm. Okay, back to the health service.
Yeah.
How do you see things going in the next 5-10 years? I mean, you know, people are struggling to get to grips with the current situation. How successful do you think they're going to be? Which way is it going to turn? Is it going to get worse before it gets better?
Ooh, is it going to get worse before it gets better? Look, I know that CCGs, clinical commissioning groups around the country, are sort of staring blankly at Excel spreadsheets that just don't add up at the moment. Mm. And you know, look, the NHS does a great job of keeping everyone alive, and in terms of macro health, it does a really good job. It employs an awful lot of people, you know, and it does a really good job of that. There's many, many thousands of people who are employed by the NHS, and that's a good thing for the economy. And it's relatively inexpensive. So I think at the end of the day, any government's going to look at that and think, you know, how are you going to alter? You've got 70 years worth of employment contracts. As Jeremy Hunt is finding out right now, it's incredibly difficult to change those employment contracts. Our society is not set up to change public service employment contracts. And if they want people to work within this system differently from the way they're working now, and at the end of the day, if we're talking efficiencies, it's about people working a little bit differently. Mm. It's very difficult to bring that in. The NHS lets go, in inverted commas, about 0.01% of its staff per year. So in terms of what any other business setting would talk about firing people for poor performance, the NHS lets about 0.01%. A lot of estimates would say that probably around about 10% of your staff need to be turned over to keep a really vigorous, healthy business.
That's a lot different.
Huge difference. Mm. And you can't, because of the employment contracts and because of the system and the structure and what's the motivation to actually have those difficult conversations with someone in a public service.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I actually think we're stuck with the service, and I don't mean that in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually a good way, because it's a good thing, because it's ultimately incredibly stable. So I think at the end of the day, the government's just going to have to find some more money for it. They will keep sort of talking about why we can do this and how we can do that, and every government comes in and talks around the edges, and they're going to change this, and they're going to shift this, and they're going to do that. I think more resources will go to primary care to try and promote out of hospital care, but I think fundamentally where the NHS is going to stay much the same. I can't see it changing, and it will at the moment, because it really is short of cash. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So many hospitals around the country have completely run out of money. So many situations have just, you know, the money has just shrunk. And it's not, the government understandably, you know, as part of their manifesto, have said that they're not cutting the costs of the NHS, but they've absolutely put a cap on it. And the money has been shifted around between health and social services and things, but in real terms, there's significantly less money around than there was in 2008, and the strain's going to keep showing. But look, ultimately, every country's health service, and even more so here in the UK, it's a negotiation between the taxpayer as to how much they want to spend on their health. You know, we all have a health service because without it, we would be incredibly worried about how we're going to live. We need it. We absolutely need it. Right. Now, at the moment, we have a tax rate and we have a spend, and really it's going to be a negotiation between governments who clearly want to stay in power and taxpayers who don't want to pay too much tax rightly, and how that tax money is going to be spent. But fundamentally, I can't see, and I privatising the NHS utterly misses the point. It wouldn't improve the service, and it would immediately escalate the costs. Okay, and probably so make a lot of people unemployed.
Yeah. So let's talk about all the private-public bit.
Sure.
I mean, the NHS is always compared with, you know, what's happened in America, you know, in the private system. That's the sort of classic thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, nobody here wants the kind of, you know, kind of brutal side of the American situation where people are literally there bankrupted by getting sick and this kind of thing. Terrible. Mm. And we're all very pleased indeed that we've got an NHS at that point. On the other side, we see, as you've been saying, the NHS is, and it's one of the largest employers on the planet. It's a massive, massive beast, and changing it is very, very difficult indeed. Whereas when you've got a lot of businesses running, they out there, if something's like cheaper and people like it and it works, you know, they'll go for it. That's not necessarily the case here, and it feels to me like one of the problems we have with the money here is this very fact, is that actually being flexible and changing towards cheaper solutions, it ain't easy at all, you know, because any change is hard. People basically, they just want to keep doing the same thing they've always been doing, you know. And if something comes up which is radically different, like a completely different approach to a health problem, well, you know, there's a whole jobs issue. There are, you know, it's just like massive. It's one big organisation that you could be talking about huge numbers of redundant people, you know. Yeah. But it might be worth it, like mad, for both health and the cost, you know. So that good solution is likely to be just sort of quietly put to one side so that everything can carry on business as usual. Yeah. So it's a big issue. Now you've just said, look, privatising business is in any way it's not going to be the answer, and I think many people would agree with you on that. But you do feel there's a role for the private sector, obviously, and you are actually running a piece of that yourself. Mm-hmm. So maybe you'd like to say a bit about what you do, why you do it, and exactly how you think these fit together, then, these two things.
Well, look, I mean, when I first arrived in the UK from New Zealand in 1998, I was a qualified GP, and I was looking for work. And I remember arriving in London, and amazing city, London.
Right,
truly incredible.
Yeah.
When you come from New Zealand, it feels like you travel a very long way to your own capital city in a way. But still, you know, there's a lot of things that are very, very different. Right. But I couldn't see any doctors. I was looking for a job, and really, I couldn't see them. You know, used to coming from Australia and New Zealand, where I did some work in Australia as well. There's GPs on pretty much every corner, every shopping centre. One of their core businesses, your pharmacy, your GP, so they're everywhere. And it's because of the fee-for-service system. It works so that you set up, people come, and you build a business that way. The NHS is a very different thing. But it became at that time, and then I worked for a medical assistance company, and one of my jobs is trying to find GP appointments for people who are travelling through the UK. And through London, and it was really, really difficult. There's just, even with the private service, and we all know there's lots and lots of private doctors in London, it's still trying to call up in the morning and trying to find an appointment on behalf of someone who's travelling who doesn't know London is actually really difficult. And to be honest, it's probably the only city, I'd say the only city on the planet, that money won't get you a doctor just like that. Pretty much everywhere else you are, no matter how rough the city may be on every other level, if you've got the money, you're going to get a doctor to come and visit you in a flash.
Interesting view, right. Okay.
Exactly. So it's really unique in that sense. Mm. But the NHS does a fantastic job, as we've established, but there are lots and lots of people who find it difficult to access. And I think there's a massive gap there. you know, lots and lots of people wake up in the middle of the night, they're feeling like they've got a sore throat, tonsillitis developing, they kind of know what they need. And there's just no availability to be able to go online, make an appointment, book for someone 11 o'clock that can be between your meetings while you're in London if you're a commuter or if you're travelling through, and to be able to see a doctor, have the problem sorted, and then be able to go about your business. So it was with that in mind that we set up London Doctors Clinic, and we now have six clinics around London, central London, and they're based beside the main transport hubs that we can. So we have Waterloo, where we are at the moment, and King's Cross and Soho Square, Victoria Station and London Bridge, and did I say King's Cross? Anyway, we've got six of them around London. Right. So yeah, and so the concept is we're close to transport hubs, so that people can, and we have a very easy online booking system and a phone booking system if people need it. So you can always get an appointment right up to the last minute. Our charge is only £55, so we've looked for a price point that we think is reasonable for someone who's working in London, and we've looked at the price point, to be honest, that covers our costs rather than tries to maximise profit, and we'll see how that goes. We're a startup, we really only started, got really underway last November, so right. You know, and we've opened this, I started myself with two small clinics. And got some investment from Oakfield Capital Investors. We're working together we now have the six clinics. And the patients are coming in. And it's an interesting phenomenon, really, because they obviously really, really enjoy the convenience. They find it, you know, right. Knowing that they've got an appointment and that it's only going to take them 15 minutes out of their day. You know, they may work 5 minutes away, so they know when they're going to be seen. Their whole process is over and done with. We dispense commonly used medications, so they come and they see the doctor and they walk out with the medications they need, the letter they may or may not need. Say, you know, they might need a letter to say they're fit to run the Paris Marathon, that type of thing. So they walk out with all of that package and they're back at their desk again in under half an hour. So, you know, there's that. And but one of the really interesting phenomena that I'm finding is that so many British people are sitting there where you are right now, and they'll say that, look, I know the NHS is under a huge amount of pressure, I can afford it, so it's nice to actually have an option to be able to not bother my GP back home wherever I live outside of London with something that I know that I can fix myself. Now, to be honest, I'm not sure whether that's people just telling me how well off they are or whether that's a genuine civil feeling of civil responsibility, but that does seem to be quite a common feeling, is that people would really like to have an alternative that they can use. And we're hoping to provide that.
So you see yourself as fulfilling two roles in a way there. One is the convenience one, that it doesn't disrupt somebody's life unduly for something which is maybe quite minor.
Yeah.
Secondly, actually because it's maybe quite minor, they remove that from the overburdened health service, which we'll probably invest as much time and money in doing that as anything else.
Yeah, well, see, I'm still an NHS GP. I'm still a partner in a practice in Wandsworth,
right.
And
right.
I'm a CCG on the Clinical Commissioning Board. And you know, we have no intention in London Doctors Clinic to replace the NHS.
No,
we see it as working alongside it and helping to a certain extent, you know, both the patient and perhaps the service. I think there's an awful lot more that could be done in a parallel private system to relieve the pressure. I think our six clinics are unlikely to put a huge dent in the need for the NHS, but you never know.
Interesting. So it's interesting because it's a change of culture, is that you know, most people of course don't expect to pay for health in this country, which is good, but it's also a bad thing because of course, you know, there is the other side of it, which where they're not exactly valuing and they go and consult the doctor far too often about nothing very much. This kind of thing is also happens. So it is a big cultural change, but nonetheless it's quite enticing. You know, £55 I would consider coming to consult with you. rather than wait 3 weeks to have an appointment with a doctor I've never seen before anyway, in my practice. And I don't go that often, but when I do, I never see the same person twice. So what the hell, I might as well come and see you. So maybe it is something that will work.
I think so. Look, I mean, there's a lot of things that the NHS doesn't cover, for example.
Right.
If you need a private sick note, if you need, as I mentioned before, a letter to say that you're fit to run the Paris Marathon, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, the French system needs that.
Yep.
If you need a taxi driving medical, if you need a gun owner's medical, there's a huge raft of things that, that society absolutely need a doctor to sign off.
Right.
That the NHS doesn't cover. Mm. So you have to pay the NHS for that anyway.
Okay.
Now, some practices are very, very well set up to provide that, and they rely on that for an element of income, and that's great. But there's a number of practices that, that are not interested in that at all, and they're a massive nuisance to that practice because they're busy looking after people who are ill, and to then sort of, you know, try and fit in that type of thing can be difficult for them. So there's a huge call for convenience, and I, with the best will in the world, even with a lot more money in the NHS, I don't think the NHS is ever going to be in a position to provide that level of convenience.
Mm. The nearest I've seen to that was once where I needed an emergency appointment and I went to a walk-in clinic.
Yeah, exactly.
That was flipping good. I love that.
Yeah.
I was seen immediately.
Absolutely.
And then I waited 3/4 of an hour and got seen to, you know, it's like...
Yeah.
This is what you need.
No, totally. And I agree. And the NHS has developed a number of walk-in clinics.
Mm.
But as they become increasingly popular, the wait at walk-in clinics get longer and longer. and there's, you know, that type of thing. But look, I suppose in a sense, that's what we see our core group of people as being. That the type of, as you would say, the type of person that would think they've got something, they go to a walk-in clinic and that type of thing. So we're providing a service that just focuses on convenience and simple health problems. And if, you know, sometimes people need referrals to their private specialists, but more often than not, they just need something that a GP can fix for them.
Mm. Okay, can you put on your CCG hat now?
Yeah, of course.
Just talk a little bit about something which we, you know, I head up a charity which is helping people, and one of the things we have a great interest in is the development of personal health budgets.
Yeah.
Now, they are something that successive different governments seem to have managed to keep nudging along. Nobody's stopped them yet, which is quite surprising. But in terms of a cultural change within the NHS, to me they're the biggest change since the day it was invented, because they actually moved the onus of you talk about this overused phrase patient-centered care, and patient choice. They're the two big buzzwords for how many decades? Long time. Anyway, this to me is the first real appearance of those things. If you have a personal health budget and you can decide, well, actually, I'd like to employ this person to be my carer because actually I really like them,
mm-hmm.
and they do a great job, and I don't really want this particular kind of aid that the NHS puts out. I want to buy this slinky one that comes from the Far East and is easy to fold up and goes to my boot and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they actually get what they need, and you can have a very, very happy customer at the other end of that process quite often. I've been to every single personal health budget event that I've been able to get to since I first heard about them. So I'd just like to hear from the CCG's point of view, well, this is a massive cultural change,
mm-hmm.
and I can't think that the CCGs would have dreamt up something like this themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much something coming from the government on behalf of the people, you know, which is, that's what they are supposed to do, but they don't do it as often as we might like. But here is a great initiative, I feel, coming on behalf of the people to change the healthcare, which wouldn't otherwise do this.
Yeah.
So can you give us a bit of an insight as to how these are being looked at the CCG? Because we've now got a directive to roll out a lot of them in the next 4 years, haven't you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. They've been, I mean, in Wandsworth CCG, we're absolutely believers in them. They're a
right.
great idea. They need to be monitored fairly closely because, of course, there's some people who... in that situation who are really quite vulnerable, and they can be vulnerable to all sorts of ways of spending their personal health budget unwisely.
Right.
But it's for people who have the capacity to do it, and also for a lot of people who you may think don't have the capacity to do it are doing incredibly well with it.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
Right.
They make a huge amount of difference. People have choices as to how they spend their money.
Mm.
And there's no question, sometimes those choices make the the hair on the back of your neck stand up a little.
A lot of breath drawn between teeth.
There are occasions. But I think in an overall sense, it's a fantastic thing. It really is. It's making a huge difference to an awful lot of people.
Mm.
Like so many interventions, though, it tends to be the educated middle classes that do best out of it. But, you know, there's a lot of educated middle class people in the UK.
Who are sick and need help. So, you know, we're kind of excited about them because of the things you said. They do actually provide such big insoluble problems that they deal with it just like that, like the ridiculous trade-off between social care and healthcare.
Exactly.
And they've been trying to work out how to make these two monster beasts work together, and of course they don't.
Yeah.
And you know, and you're just stuck there in the middle with them, saying, "Well, we're going to take that away from there."
Yeah.
And you know, and it's just a terrible, terrible thing at the expense of some poor person.
Mm.
And you give them the money, and they spend it with one or the other as they like,
exactly.
And you solve the problem straight away in one stroke. And
it has been a cultural shift, and it has had to be, I think, mandated from above, as it were, in order for it to happen, because the structure of both the health and the social services are not readily ones that trust the patient particularly. There is a for reasons that they get held accountable. So, you know, and even now, if they were to give the personal budget to the wrong person and bad things happen, they'd probably still be held accountable, but that's okay. They can live with that. they can cope with that. But another really valuable thing from it is forcing health and social care to work together.
Yes.
And it has been very, very difficult, to be honest, as a commissioner, to find practical ways for health and social care to really work together, because they do provide different functions in society, and they are funded utterly differently, and they're, you know, the social care, the local government is more of a political establishment, whereas the health service is much more of a civil service, and there's many, many incredible cultural differences between these two organisations.
Hence the lack of abilities to work together.
It seems such an obvious thing that they should work together.
Yeah.
A social worker and doctors and district nurses should be working absolutely hand in hand.
Mm.
And there's been a number of projects where it does work.
Mm.
You know,
they've been trying very hard for a long time, haven't they? Yeah.
Of course. But we're still a ways to go yet.
Ways to go. That's fair enough. Yeah, and I think the other thing is, we were talking about the buzzwords, so the patient choice thing,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, the way I look at it is the arrival of the NHS must have been the most wonderful thing ever for most people. You know what I mean? Just fantastic, you know, this thing arriving. But the concept, though, needs to move on as society moves on. And society, the attitudes towards things in the public are very different now to, you know, back in the middle of the last century. And at the moment, we have when it comes to choice, it's kind of like a bit like sort of communist healthcare. Well, this is what you can have, which one do you want? You know, it's not like, well, what if I don't want any of those? Well, that's, you know, well, you don't get any healthcare in that case.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that everything doesn't have to fit a prescribed model, which is how health is seen by the medical profession right now, that's an enormous relief to people, I think.
Yeah.
Because, you know, many of the people that we're helping are actually looking outside the box. They have to, a lot of them, because the box hasn't got anything in it for them.
Yeah.
So they're looking elsewhere. But every single thing that they look at, they have to pay for, and they're sick. So, you know, it's a terrible, terrible situation.
Mm.
And there's no reason, in my mind, why it should have to be like that. Why they're sort of outcasts in some way, and they're not provided for in the same way that somebody there is something in the box, they're provided for. So it's a massive change, and I think when people people don't realise that they're even happening yet. Generally, personal health budgets, I talk to doctors quite often, they don't know what they are.
Exactly.
You know, they really haven't got into the consciousness yet. But I think once people see what they can do. You know, and I have seen quite a lot of what we've done. I've seen the examples of how they've actually completely transformed lives. I think, you know, they're going to be welcomed with open arms.
Yeah.
And
I agree totally. And the reason why they haven't been adopted is not so much a resistance to them. It's just this, the
it's
immense.
Difficult.
Well, it's, it's just difficult to get anything done in something the size of the NHS. And you know, it's there's lots and lots of committees that every single thing, every single idea needs to be transferred into an A4, usually a big 20 A4, maybe 100 bits of A4, and then that has to go through a whole series of committees, and everyone has to agree.
Yeah.
And that's just the way the system is. If anyone in that system comes along and makes a decision where the committee hasn't made the decision and something goes wrong, and it always will, that individual will have no recourse.
Yeah.
So the entire system, the way that we as a democracy have assessed that we need to monitor our taxpayers' money is by having a committee. And I understand that. It makes sense. You can't go giving taxpayers' money to some maverick creative person like me who goes and spends it all the way I see fit. That's not how it can work. So we are stuck with these committees, but it means that things are very slow and very conservative. But they are on their way. Personal health budgets, they've developed a momentum. I'd be very, very surprised to see them pull back. And this makes so much sense. It actually reduces, of course,
the burden of health, the health service. People are looking after themselves. They're in charge. It's great. You give them the tools and they get on with the job.
It may put some people out of a job in the ones that are currently processing all of these things, which is probably part of the reason why there's a certain slight resistance to it. But that's not for the patient to be concerned about.
Yeah, well, glad to hear your enthusiasm for that. We share that.
Do you not find that in your charity?
Generally speaking, people don't know about them. So they don't even understand them. Part of my job is to work out how they're progressing, how they're going to relate to the people that are our beneficiaries, and how they could help them. They haven't started to help them yet, but I think they will.
Yeah.
And we're trying to help that process along. So I'm very interested in them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're just a two-bit charity that's trying to help people out financially with some of these costs. Well, I mean, you know, they had a personal health budget and we could manage it for them. That'd be fantastic.
I agree.
Okay, well, look, thanks very much. We're going to have to wrap it up there. But thanks so much for coming on the show. It's great, as I said, to be able to talk to somebody who's sort of behind the scenes there doing all this stuff with CCGs. We don't so often get the chance, and we're just on the receiving end. And things look different, so it's really good to hear.
That's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
It's always good to hear another perspective on health and healthcare. You may have been particularly interested by the talk of personal health budgets. It's likely that you've never heard of them, despite the fact that they're now enshrined in law and government has set a target of 50 to 100,000 of them to be up and running within 4 years. As I said during the interview, personal health budgets have been a great personal interest of mine for several years now. But their relevance to the people we're helping has, up to now, always been a long way off. So that's now all changing. So I'm planning to dedicate a show to the subject soon in order to let you know what they are, how they work, and how you might consider the possibility of one as a way of supporting integrated medicine choices for cancer. Watch this space. All of the previous Yes to Life shows are available on demand from UK Health Radio. So do have a browse, as I've had some brilliant guests over the last year, ranging from top author Sophie Savage, interviewed before she wrote the extraordinary Cancer Whisperer, to international science writer Ralph Moss, best-selling author of Radical Remission, Dr. Kelly Turner, NHS professors such as Professor Robert Thomas, Professor Angus Dalgleish, and Professor Sanjeev Krishna, experts in the field of nutrition such as Patrick Holford, Drs. Andrea Williams, Kirsten Chick, Liz Butler, not to mention integrative doctors such as Dr. Contreras of the Oasis of Hope Hospital in Mexico, and household names like Janie Lee Grace and Jason Vale. As usual, links to the material mentioned in the show are on the Yes to Life website. Go to yestolife, yestolife.org.uk, click the link to Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar, and then choose UK Health Radio. Our new book, The Cancer Revolution, written by Patricia Peat and 37 international experts, is selling like hot cakes, I'm pleased to say, and receiving great reviews. Do check it out at thecancerrevolution.co.uk. And also do follow us on social media. That's as Yes to Life, as The Cancer Revolution, and as me, Robin Daly. Next week, amazingly, marks the first birthday of the show, and so I thought it would be interesting to revisit some of my guests from over the year to catch up on developments. Please join me again. Goodbye.